G'day everybody, I'm Glenn Hill.
I'm Jacob Meyer.
Welcome to another Tactical Tennis Podcast episode.
I gotta start with the big news of probably Novak Djokovic's. I think we touched on the fact that he fired his whole team.
Yeah, we did.
That was
supposed to be a podcast about high-level coaching, and it basically turned into the Novak Djokovic coaching team podcast. But
that happens.
Obviously, and he hired Becker, not Becker, Agassi.
No, actually, Becker quit. He didn't fire Becker, to be fair.
No, I never said he fired Becker. I said he hired Becker
right. Because
I'm an idiot. But yeah.
No, that was my implication because I said he fired his whole team. So Becker left, obviously, about 6 months ago or something like that in the middle of 2016.
Yeah, we're almost a year ago. So yeah, it was almost a year ago now.
Wow. I got to work on my math.
And your calendar reading skills.
I've at least got an excuse. I mean, I'm fighting off a cold over here. You're just, it's just the middle of the week for you. So, and anyway, Andre Agassi, I know the rumors were flying, and I know that some journalists were getting chewed out on Twitter because people thought that there was no way that was going to happen. Andre has never coached anyone before. At least not formally, not that we've heard about in the media. So
no, not at all. And we can't really call this like a formal hiring yet. They're both very cautious in the way that they're talking about this. It's, Djokovic says, we're excited to work together and see where it takes us. It's just us trying to get to know each other in Paris a little bit. And then Agassi said this, I have no interest in imposing what I believe on someone. As a part of his talking about coaching. So that's interesting, especially when you put that together with the fact that the plan at present is that Agassi isn't even going to stay with Novak for the entire tournament.
Well, I think this should be clear that if you have any insight into Andre Agassi as a person, he certainly doesn't need to coach Novak or anyone else. And I don't think he's going to stick around if it's not something that brings him some sort of fulfillment.
Absolutely. I mean, the guy doesn't exactly need to do it for the money. That should be patently obvious.
He's one of the wealthiest tennis players. I mean, he might be second behind Fed.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd be surprised if that was the case. But, between
years ago, they said he was worth over $300 million.
Yeah. Sure, but yeah, add in Steffi's obviously won a little prize money herself over the years. So money isn't the object here, and in a strange way, love of the game probably isn't either, because his kind of love hate relationship with tennis is well documented.
And so, I think that there's a sense in which he really does want to give back.
Yes.
I mean, we know that he really struggled with the game. If you haven't, shameless plug here for Mr. Agassi, right? If you haven't read Open, which is his autobiographical book, it's still one of the best sports books ever written. And obviously, Andre had a lot of help writing it. I can't remember the name of his ghostwriter, but really, really good. Lots of insight into him.
Yes, it's a compelling read. It's a very compelling read.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think he's always expressed this understanding of what tennis has given to him and had a desire to give back. But I do find it interesting that he is getting back into tennis. Here's the other part of the quote. So I read part of it when I said, I have no interest in imposing what I believe on someone. And then he continues, I would have a lot of interest in somebody's desire to want to make themselves better and possibly me being a vehicle that's best to help them take those steps. Those would be the two working components that would either keep me from coaching or make me ever do it. And so in this case, I think there's a sense in where Agassi maybe looks at what Novak's going through and the struggles and obviously has some understanding of what it's like to lose your desire and or struggle with your desire, at least, and your motivation and your dedication, because that's something he obviously had difficulties with at various points, and sees the opportunity to have a holistic impact on Novak's life, maybe in something that goes beyond just tennis. And that's the kind of project that I could see Agassi being willing to get on board for.
I think in a very real way, Agassi's interest here with Novak has nothing to do with where he's going to hit the ball.
I mean, I do think he'll have input on that. I think he'll have input on how Djokovic goes out there and plays.
Sure, but, absolutely.
But by and large, no, absolutely. I mean, I think this is much more... You know, this brings about this whole idea of, the quote-unquote celebrity coaches where we've seen over the last, few years with Edberg helping Fed and Becker throwing his name in the hat. I mean, we've had a whole slew of former number ones and top-level players.
Yeah, can we not use that term?
What, the celebrity coach thing? Yeah, I'm not a big fan of it either.
But yeah, I'm not either.
I mean, there's this idea here of why would you go to a former extremely high-level player to bring them on board as a coach? Because they're not, generally speaking, look, I'm not going to one of those guys to get technique work done. Like, I'm not going to go to one of them to work on my serve or work on my volleys or my forehand or my backhand.
Right, most of them never studied those things.
No, exactly. I mean, that's not their forte. What I would maybe go to them about is help, for some of them, help on the tactical side of things. But largely also there's that question of just getting their input on managing being a top-level professional and helping work through the highs and lows in motivation and just the managing the life and having somebody to really share ideas with and collaborate with. And Agassi, I think, for Djokovic, especially where Djokovic is at this point now, that would be, I think, something where Agassi has a lot to offer.
I think there's a way in which when you're at the top of the tennis world, the game can be very lonely in the sense that there's really very few athletes or people anywhere that are going through or have gone through what you're going through. And one of the things that's interesting about this generation in tennis is if you go back a couple generations to say like Jimmy Connors or John McEnroe, I mean, those guys did not train the way that, Novak trains. Like, nobody was sleeping in hyperbaric chambers.
No, it's nothing like and, this. They're working
360 days a year. So
absolutely.
There's a very real sense in which the guys on the tour feel like, you don't know what I'm going through. And they don't necessarily want to trust a lot of the advice that they're getting, in large part because a lot of the advice that they're getting is not... it's just not good enough. A lot of the times it's too extreme, right? Where you have someone like, you should train like a marathon runner, or somebody else says you should train like a bodybuilder, and somebody else says, well, you shouldn't train at all. You should just play lots of matches. And there's a sense in which the sport is really in the midst of an early generation, like an evolution. And so it's not easy for these top guys to know where to turn to. And so I think the reason that they turn to like really just famous players is because they feel a sense of camaraderie with them where it makes them feel a little bit less alone. Like, hey, you've been here in the media spotlight at these same places. I mean, let's not forget Roland Garros has been around for a long time. You know, the Wimbledon Club has been there in the same place for a long time. So these are literally the same locations and the same tournaments. Not every week, but in large part for years and years and decades where, these top players, say from the last 30 years, they can tell you stories about people that they can identify with and locations that they know very well. And they still know a lot of the people that are sort of involved in the tour, whether they're running tournaments or sponsors or doing all sorts of different kind of stuff. But it's almost like a comfort thing. It's not like Boris Becker was out there masterminding, complex game plans for Novak.
Yeah, that just Boris wasn't well known for having complex game plans. It was, I'm going to hit the ball really hard on my serve, and I'm going to run forward and dive if I need to. I mean, obviously, he did actually play a surprising amount of baseline tennis. But there's a part where I understand what you're saying, and then there's another part of it where I want to point out that this idea of former top players coaching current top players is very new. I mean, this is a recent phenomenon. If we don't go, I mean, was Murray Lendl the first kind of pairing like this really that we can think of? I mean, you could talk about Gilbert Agassi, but you know, as yeah. much as Gilbert made
Gilbert
number
Atkinson.
Well, sure, but I mean, as much as Gilbert made number four in the world, just nobody thinks about him in the same way that we think about, you know, a Becker or an Agassi or an Lendl or an Edberg as a player.
I just think that that's, I think that that is a product of, let's say, the circumstances of media in this particular point in time. Because Gilbert was top. I mean, Gilbert was a top five player.
Yeah, he peaked out at four. But he also never won a slam. Like, he never even made a slam final.
Yeah, I just don't think that that's all that important. I think that, you know, there's always been a sense in which players have turned to other players. I mean, this is after that, but look at, I don't know, Larry Stefanke and Andy Roddick. I mean, Stefanke was a good player.
He was good, but he wasn't great.
Yeah, I understand that.
I'm just going to cut in real quick. Like, Gilbert never made it past the quarters of a slam.
I actually didn't know that. That's pretty remarkable that he was four in the world, never made semis.
Yeah, well, because he grounded a lot of small tournaments. So he made the quarters at Wimbledon once, and the quarters at the US Open once. Never made it past the fourth round at the Australian Open, never made it past the third round at the French.
That's weird. I would kind of think that he'd be good in five-set matches. But, and look, I think that what you're really pointing out is that in the past, guys that have won multiple slams haven't ended up coaching as much, where a lot of people that didn't win multiple slams did end up coaching. I mean, there's so many people. I don't even know, like, there are guys coaching college tennis that were top 10 in the world in the United States. I mean, sure. Steve Denton down at Texas A&M, I think, was top 10. The UCLA coach
semis like at the Australian 20. 1 year. Dent did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously Phil Dent was a good player. I mean, there's a lot of guys, especially the Americans and the Australians, that really jumped to mind, that really got really involved with coaching. I think just the way that we talk about it now and the way it gets made out by the media is different. And I think that there's a sense in which there's more money overall in tennis and there's more motivation for people to get involved. I mean, Brad Gilbert's on TV every day now, where, you know,
yeah, but Gilbert's not worth $300 million and Agassi is. No. You know, there's that question of there's more money, but a lot of these guys that are now coming back into the game to coach, they're not doing it for money. At least
okay,
I wouldn't think so.
So what's making Andre come back into the game? Because this is what's really interesting to me.
Right, and I think that's really the big question. And again, I think it comes down to this idea of he sees an opportunity to impact Djokovic in a way that goes beyond hitting tennis balls. I think he sees the opportunity to also be something of a mentor to Djokovic and to kind of guide him through this period where he's, you know, having such a tough time and dealing with all these things. And I think that's something that appeals to Andre. I think also, you know, the possibility that he can do it on a very limited basis. You know, because he's not hitting the road for 30 weeks a year. That's not happening.
I actually don't think that that's it. I think that you nailed it when you said, when you used the word mentor. I think that, you know, Andre has been very upfront about Gil Reyes being a massive influence on his life. And for that matter, Brad Gilbert was a massive influence.
Yeah. No, yeah. But his relationship with Gil Reyes goes beyond that, though. I mean, obviously Gilbert had a massive influence on his life. But, I mean, he views Reyes like literally like family.
Well, Gil is a mentor, I think, in the robust sense of the word.
Yes.
Not a mentor in like, well, that guy taught me how to hit cross-court angle or something.
Right.
But a mentor in the sense that these guys are joined for life. And I think in a very real way, I mean, I know for a fact that a lot of the American tennis players have reached out to Andre in one way or another and that he has been generous with his time. And he's, you know, he talks to people and he tries to help out and sort of give whatever he can that he thinks is going to be helpful. But I think the thing that would really motivate him to work closely with someone is if he can have the kind of impact on someone else in a deep, meaningful, philosophical kind of way that Gil had on him.
Sure. No, I completely agree with that. But I think that the time thing is also a factor. You know, when I said it's not that he's doing this only, like he's doing this because he can only do it. What I'm trying to say is, if he had to be out on the tour with somebody 30 weeks a year or 40 weeks, he wouldn't do it. There's no way Agassi's stepping out to do that. That's
what I'm saying is, don't be surprised if this relationship does take off. Don't be surprised if Andre ends up coaching a lot more than he says he's going to.
See, I will be surprised if
40 weeks? No, because Novak doesn't play 40 weeks. But what I'm saying is that if he's going to get really close to someone, then he may end up spending a lot more time with him than he would plan. I mean, he's fully capable of taking his family on the road. He's got young kids there in school.
Yeah, I just don't see him doing that, though. That's my point. Huh? I just don't think he's got any interest in being out on the road. And he's talked about this before. I don't think he has any interest in being out on the road that much. What I think he sees is an opportunity to come in and mentor Djokovic for select periods throughout the year and step away and obviously stay in touch through, you know, phone and internet and whatnot, and then come back again and just kind of, it's almost like a touchstone. He's just going to keep coming back to him throughout the year and keeping him on course and being there to help guide him. But I don't think he's going to end up coaching for 20, 30 weeks a year. I don't think that's realistic. In his motivation and what he wants. But then the other part of the question is, what do we think his impact on Djokovic will actually be?
I think if they actually do something, like if they really work together, I think the impact has the potential to be tremendous. To me, Novak was really struggling. I mean, it a lot depends on how you see Novak, okay? The way that I saw him was coming from a particular place where, I mean, he comes from a place that's not safe. He comes from a place that is not very nice in some ways. Now, I'm saying that, of course, as a like incredibly overprivileged American that grew up in one of the nicest, quaint communities that you can find anywhere. But, I mean, Novak grew up in a place that was a war-torn country that was just not, it just wasn't really a nice place. I mean, I'm trying to say it sort of as gently as I can. And when he was out on the tour and when he was young, I mean, this guy had a burning desire inside of him that had a strength to it where it's fully possible, looking at it now, that it wasn't entirely what I would call healthy. Now, it was healthy for his bank account because he had a heck of a killer instinct, and man, I mean, he would just outwork. I mean, he outworked the whole world.
Well, sort of, but then, I mean, he also had that history of retiring from matches. I mean, there's a duality there that I think maybe isn't quite as clean as, you know, you're making it sound right now.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think that there's like a total lack of balance there where he hated to lose so much. I mean, he retired from Grand Slams more than anybody ever. I'm not sure if that's actually the accurate stat, but it sure feels that way. It sure feels like he has more retirements than anyone else. I mean, it seemed like he didn't want to take losses. And it was really bad. And I'll be honest, I mean, I was really low on him. And you know this about me. Long before we started the podcast, I was very unimpressed with the way he handled himself in those situations.
I think a lot of people were unimpressed. You know, you're not alone in that.
I think a lot of people were. To me, I see that as a part of the unhealthy energy that was driving him. I think that, I mean, his brother's been very forthcoming that he had a lot of self-hate and a lot of self-doubt that really drove, basically that motivated his tennis career. Now we're talking about Marco here for a second. I think that it's not out of the question to look and see a lot of that in Novak. And one of the things that's happened over the last couple of years And even before he got involved with the Love and Peace Academy with Pepe Maz, even before that, you saw Novak start to try and reinvent himself as what I hate to say it, but I'm going to say in Mr. Federer's image as Mr. Nice Guy.
Oh, he had a deep desire to be liked.
It was desperate. It was literally desperate, where it was like, it's effortless for Federer. Literally me, like some guy that he's got no idea what my name is, but I run into him in the locker room. And the first time that I met him in person, I almost hit him in the face with a door, and he's apologizing to me.
Yeah.
And the second time that I met him in person and spoke to him, you know, he's gently interrupting and taking time out to just be a polite guy. And there's no cameras around. There's nothing around, you know, for him to work. Like,
it's just natural. Yeah. There's nobody who's met Fed who has a bad, it's funny. I was just down in Mobile for the NAIA National Championships, and I was talking to one of the referees down there, and she umpires a lot of ATP matches and just worked at the slams and whatnot. And I can't remember how it came up, but she was just saying, he's just such an incredibly nice guy. Like, she's just never seen him behave in a way ever, on or off the court, that was distasteful. But Djokovic didn't have that reputation.
No.
He retired from matches a lot. You know, he complained a lot. It was
more than that, he rubbed people the wrong way. Like, yeah. He wanted to hurt you. Not like physically hurt you, but like he wanted to beat the snot out of you. And don't get me wrong, Federer is ultra competitive, and there's a sense in which that's covered up a little bit by his niceness off the court. But Novak would there's just a very different energy about him. And so he's gone about this process for years now of trying to reinvent himself. And this is the thing that I think really draws Andre to him, where I think in a very real way, Novak doesn't know how to maintain his killer instinct on the court and be a nice guy off the court. Like, he wants to be this sort of deep thinker, philosophical kind of guy that helps the world and that can contribute to the greater good. And at the same time, he wants to be unbeatable on the court, and he wants to go down as the best of all time. And he wants to do it by absolutely crushing his opponents.
Sure.
And that's how he thinks about it.
Yeah. But bringing this back to Agassi, we've talked about the mentor side of things. Just from a purely tennis perspective, what is Agassi going to bring to the table? How do we see him influencing the way Djokovic goes out and plays? Because, as we've mentioned, Agassi's not going to come in and be a technical coach. Like, he's not going to come in and change the way that Djokovic serves or hit ground strokes or anything like that. The impact that he's going to have outside of the bigger picture life management side of things, just in the tennis perspective, has got to be tactical. It's going to be limited to the tactical setting. Do we anticipate seeing a shift in the way Djokovic tries to play the game?
I think you're going to see him play with a commitment to hitting the cover off the ball that has been lacking for the last year.
You're going to see him be more aggressive, step up in the court more, and hit the ball harder with more aggression in terms of the pace or angle.
Yeah, well, the idea is that this is what would happen if Novak had a more sort of coherent sense of self. He's battling himself out there most of the time. And I think that Andre's going to address that. And through addressing that, he's also going to integrate with the tennis. So, to me, that's more than just a tactical thing, and it's more than just a psychological thing. I think that what's really the potential that's really interesting for Andre is he's gone through this himself. I think he's going to be able to say, look, you have to be able to think these things, to feel this way off the court, to have a certain amount of love for yourself and for your opponent and for the game that's genuine. Andre really feels that, and he has felt the lack of that as well. I think all these things potentially can come together, and I think this is what draws Novak to him. I think that Andre is probably the only guy that has playing experience that can say, look, I hated the game for a long time. And, he had a terrible reputation in the media for a long time, and right, then became one of the most beloved players on the tour. He has done what Novak's trying to do.
No, I understand that. And I feel like that's a lot of what we talked about earlier. I was just talking about in terms of X's and O's. How do we see Djokovic play now if Agassi influences the way that he plays?
And you can, yeah, I mean, it's more it's more pace and more aggression, like you said. And you can think of it almost as just he's going to play more points that are his good points and less points. You know how he plays those points where it's like he's just lost? Like, he just makes these errors out of nowhere where you know that he doesn't need to make that error, but he just makes soft errors. I mean, those really aren't X's and O points to me. I mean, those are thought process and psychology points.
Sure. I can agree with that, but yeah. Okay. All right. Let's move on.
There's more to talk about. It's been a busy couple of weeks on the tour.
It has. It's been a very busy couple of weeks.
Before we move on, or maybe in transition to do this, what are your expectations for Novak at the French Open? Next week, main draw starts. Qualifying draw is going on right now.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the draw yet. Is the draw out?
No, qualifying draw is right now. The main draw comes out in a couple of days.
Okay, so a lot of this is going to depend on the draw for Novak. You know, it's funny because he obviously had that emphatic win over Thiem at the last tournament. Was it 1-0 or 1-1?
It was 1-0.
I mean, it's a crushing win. And so, you know, we see a lot of people reacting, oh, Novak's back, Novak's back. And the next day he loses in straight sets to Zverev. And,
yeah,
you know, to me, I wasn't that shocked because when everyone was saying that Novak was back after that semifinal win, all I'm thinking back to is some of the stuff that we've discussed over the last few months, which is Novak can still come out and bring it for a match or a couple matches. There's never been a question of that. What he struggled to do is bring it day after day after day, which is something that he was doing a year or 2 years ago. And so to see that letdown in the final wasn't shocking to me. I think what's going to end up happening with Novak depends hugely on the draw in a way that it didn't matter a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, essentially, you only had to look out for one or two matches. It was a question of when does he meet Nadal, when does he meet a Federer, when does he meet like maybe somebody like Delpo who has the firepower, or Wawrinka, to really actually hit through his defense. And outside of that, you just didn't really care. It just didn't matter. And now I think it matters a lot. Because
it's okay. I think Delpo is going to be seeded like 28 or 29. I think he's ranked 30 now this week.
Well, it's not really about that. It's more about when we look through the draw when it comes out, what we have to watch out for is when Djokovic has to play like a few matches in a row, like two or three matches in a row against people who can actually press him, who can play genuinely good ball. And that's not to say, look, I mean, anybody in the top 10 can play good ball, but that doesn't mean, you know, I mean, we're talking about the clay, we're talking about Roland Garros, we're talking about best of five. There's not that many people who can go out and really press Novak, even when he's not playing his best.
Well, you remember how he lost to Istomin in Australia.
Right. And I mean, Istomin played very well.
And he played very aggressively. He was going for it. If you look at it from Novak's point of view, Novak didn't play aggressively. I mean, that's the way that he loses is by giving someone else the opportunity to try and take it from him. And then if they step up and they play well.
Right.
Well, and in Paris, if Novak's not playing aggressively enough, then, you know, guys have a lot of time. They have a lot of time to attack him.
Well, now, the difference is this. Like, I'm just sitting here looking at the top 30 in the world right now. And as I was saying, like, if you go back a year or 2 years ago at Paris, like, in the French Open, you could ignore almost everybody in the draw and pick out three or four people out of the 128 players that were genuinely some kind of a threat. And just the reality is now, if you ask Novak to go out and play one great match, I think he can go out there and play one great match. If you ask him to go out and play two great matches back-to-back, he's not able to do that the way that he could, you know, a year or 2 years ago. And if you ask him to play three great matches back-to-back, you've got a real problem. And so I look at the draw now, and I start thinking, well, look, if he gets a draw where he has to play a couple tough guys in a row, all of a sudden, that list of people that we have to worry about goes up, because I expect his quality to waver, just like we saw, you know, over the weekend. And so it's not just suddenly, you know, Murray and Murray and Wawrinka, Nadal and Federer you have to worry about now. I mean, even though he pasted TM just over the weekend, like, you have to worry about TM now.
Team's a tough matchup for him.
Oh, he is. You know, and you have to worry about...
Novak is a tough matchup for Team.
He is, but I'm just saying, like, I still think that if Team plays Novak after Novak's played somebody like Goffin or Dimitrov or Tsonga, you know, I think he's much more vulnerable. Now, all of a sudden, there's this list of, you know, look at the top 30, and there's, like, 10 guys in there who I think in the right circumstances are real threats. And then that makes Novak's chances at the tournament go down dramatically. And so...
Yeah, I mean, if he draws Nick Kyrgios, he's losing.
See, I don't necessarily agree with that. But my point is, if he draws Nick Kyrgios and then draws, let's say, Nishikori, then we've got a problem. You know, I'm just plucking Nishikori out of thin air. But I'm just saying, if he has to beat a Kyrgios and then beat somebody else good immediately after, I think we look and we expect a certain letdown. And that's where I think he's looking. So much of this is draw dependent for Novak in a way that the draw didn't used to matter very much, and now I think it is everything to him this year. If moving forward, you know, as his physical side of things hopefully starts to come together better, then that becomes less of a concern. But right now, I just think he's vulnerable if he has to maintain a stretch of great play. So a lot of this, you know, the days off help him a lot, but I think a lot of this is going to come down to, look, if he plays Ferrer now, that's not a matchup that I'm worried about. You know, and I think he could play somebody like, you know, if he plays Kyrgios and then has a day against somebody, you know, like Ferrer or, you know, Haas or, I don't know, somebody way down in the rankings and then has to play another good player again, I think that's much more manageable for him. So, you know, I think we'll have to see how it all plays out.
So, first of all, the way that you just described Novak as being in trouble if he draws the wrong string of opponents... I would just have to say, welcome to life for the rest of the tour.
Right, that's how it is normally, right?
That's exactly what life is like for everyone who's not in the big four. Yeah.
And I mean, look, like, Murray's obviously very vulnerable right now too. I mean, that guy hasn't exactly strung together consistent results. I mean, I think at the end of the day, when we look at the draw, I mean, Nadal's got to be the favorite heading in.
Everyone has Nadal in the favorite. He's been playing absolutely lights out. I mean, Roger's not even going to be there.
Right.
I think Stan is going to be a huge dark horse for people because Stan's been relatively quiet.
Well,
and when
Stan's
we
always,
see
it doesn't matter what's going on. Stan's always a dark horse. It's just,
well, here's the thing. When we see quiet periods from Stan, he explodes.
Yeah, it's almost like watch out. It's like he's off in his little cave, like working himself up. And then
he took some time off and now he's ready to like do something with
comes
the day.
Out, you know?
Exactly. So...
Yeah,
you know, there's going to be some interesting stuff there, but you know, I'm right there with you. I think that a string of opponents would be really tough for Novak. I mean, I think that people still have him as the number two guy. They have him as the second favorite behind Rafa, but I don't see him making the final.
No, I agree. I think TM's got better chances than Novak this time.
Now the only qualifier I put to that is if Andre sticks around, if things start to hit off with the two of them. To me, if Novak makes the final, Andre is there, and it has everything to do with Agassi. Which, you know me, you know how I feel about coaching. That's a rare thing for me to say, but I think this particular relationship, there's a potential that it could be a really good fit, and... If that happens, if the stars sort of align, then it's its own set of unique circumstances.
Sure. I agree with that, but I still think even with that, taking that into consideration, I mean,
unlikely.
There's three, maybe four people that I put ahead of Novak to win this tournament. I don't consider him the favorite. I don't think he's the second favorite right now. But let's talk a little bit about somebody who's not going to be there. Well, there's two people we could talk about who are
not going to be there. So two of the favorites.
Yeah, two people
to make it to the final.
Two people who would have the potential to have a big impact. One of them I'm not so sure about being a favorite, but certainly, you know, if we talk about Mr. Federer, then
you don't think Federer's a favorite?
No, I do.
If he was there?
I do think he's there. I think if he played, he would be very high on the list of people I think have a great chance to win the tournament.
Okay,
but obviously he's elected not to play.
he's elected not to play, but then you're telling me that you don't think Sharapova would be the favorite.
I don't.
On the women's side, because...
Yeah, I don't.
Who would be?
Well, that's, you know, let's talk about the women's draw in a minute. let's talk about Rudge for a minute here. And talk just briefly about why he's skipping the French and what that really means for the rest of the year for him. And I think, as a part of that, what that means for everybody else who would like to win a tournament during the rest of the year. Because I think it really has the potential to be that kind of a conversation of Fed skipping this clay court stretch, I think, has a massive impact and big repercussions for everybody else on the men's tour.
Well, what's the grass court tournament that Fed signed a lifetime deal with? Is it Halle?
Yeah, I think it's Halle. He plays every year.
Yeah, I think it's Watch Out Halle. He's going to win that one.
Oh, I think it's Watch Out Halle. It's Watch Out Wimbledon. It's Watch Out US, the high court swing. I mean, and this is the thing, right? So Fed has this 6 months. It's the longest break he's taken by far since the day he stepped foot on the tour as a professional tennis player. He has 6 months off, and it's the first real period that he's had since he turned pro that he got a genuine training block in, a sustained training block. Because, I mean, look, you're 1 month off over the month of December. That's not a real training block, right? I mean, it is, but there's a limited amount that you can do in that.
I've got to interrupt you here, though, because there's one space in which I think that Federer is different than almost all the other guys in the top 100, which is this. And this will make sense to you because you're the practice expert and the systems expert here, okay? Federer works on his game.
Sure.
He does not win all his practice sets. He does not win all his little practice games that they play. He does not make all his shots in practice. He makes errors more than other guys do. And it's funny because people are out there and they're like, yeah, like I'm out hitting Federer, right? It doesn't matter because he doesn't care, because he actually works on his game day in and day out, which is one of the reasons why, hello, he's Roger Federer. So that's different than everybody else. That being said, I think it makes it even more impactful, the fact that he had 6 months off to work on his game.
To me, it's very telling. If you look at the way that he served in 2001 when he played Pete at Wimbledon and the way he serves now, that's an altered service motion. Like, he has evolved the technique of his serve, and he's continued to do that over the past, you know, 15, 16 years now. You don't see that. You just don't see that with most players. Is visibly a different service motion. And so this is a guy who does work on his game, and he makes little tweaks and he makes little adjustments. But that's different to do that in the course of playing practice matches or having practice sessions at your tournaments and whatnot, as opposed to having 6 months to genuinely just work on stuff. And what we've seen is obviously he's come back and he's playing tennis at a level that we haven't seen from him in probably close to a decade now. And that's huge. I mean, that's absolutely huge. And I think when we look at what he's doing now, skipping the clay court swing, he's just basically... Look, he's talked about the knee and he's, you know, the clay makes his knee feel a little bit not so great. And that's all well and good. But, you know, most people prefer playing on clay because it's easier on the joints.
Right, but not at his level. Let's be real.
Well, look. I don't think that anybody's going to sit there and be like, man, I hurt my knee, so I'd really rather just wait for the hard court swing because it's so much easier I don't think that's the case. What I think is going on as a big part of this is, yeah, look, maybe his knee feels a little squirrely with the feet sliding and whatnot. That's possible. But I also think he sees this as an opportunity to go away and have another training block and hit the grass courts. I mean, look, if you think that Fed doesn't place winning another Wimbledon title at the very, 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 very top of his priority list, then you're a crazy person.
Yeah. And he wants to beat Novak there just as badly as Novak wants to be as popular as Fed.
I think he wants to go to Wimbledon and make a statement. He wants to go to Wimbledon and not just win that thing. He wants to win it the way that he used to when everybody else was showing up for second place. And it was like, oh, if you saw Fed in your part of the draw, you knew the maximum of how far you could make it in the tournament. It was like, I can't go past the quarters because Fed's in my quarter. When he was going out and taking guys who were top 10 in the world and embarrassing them on the grass, he wants to come out and play that kind of a tournament, I think.
I just remember talking to some of the guys that have drawn Roger in the first two rounds, And they're just like, yeah, you know, it's going to be so fun. I get to be on the court with him. I'm always going to be able to, like, tell my grandkids that I played Roger. And I'm like, dude, like, I mean, he's not warmed up yet. Like, this is the only time you have a shot. Like, if you're in the semis, or if you're in the – it's like if you're in the quarters, you're losing, okay?
Yeah, but like, back he doesn't then lose it didn't quarters. Matter. Like, back then it didn't matter.
I know, but part of that was because of the locker room power that he had. I got it.
But let's be real, that locker room power – existed for a reason.
Of course it did. Of course it did.
Just like, okay. He would go out there and just embarrass people. And so okay. I think there's a part of him that wants to come out and play that kind of a tournament.
He wants to go out. He does want to do that. He wants to go out and he wants to beat the Big Four. He wants one of those guys to be in the final. He wants to lay the smack down on him. He wants to make a statement as nice of a guy as he is.
And he wants 19 and he wants it to be at Wimbledon. And okay. Look, I think the other interesting thing to me is, look, if I had to pick, if I'm like, I've got a bit of a bum knee, And I have to worry about re-injuring and whatnot, and I'm looking at the French, and I'm looking at Wimbledon. Like, I'm sorry, I think I'm far more likely to hurt my knee on the grass re-injure my knee on the grass than
so
I am on the clay.
Here's the thing.
That's me. Right?
You have to work so hard in Paris. You know this.
I know.
You work harder
that.
In that tournament than in any other tournament in the world. He's 35 years old, okay? His knee is still a little bit swirly. It is not 100%, okay?
Right.
I think there's a real sense in which that really plays into this factor, and I think that it's not just one of the factors that plays into this decision. One is he has a genuine belief now that he can take a training block and come back better, which is it's key, because if he thought that he needed to be playing matches, then he would play. Period. And that's how he used to think earlier in his career, where I got to play the tournament, just like most of the guys on the tour. They just play everything, even if it's not the best thing for them. The knee plays into it legitimately because, I mean, he'd have to work really, really hard there. And then the one thing that we haven't talked about, which I think plays really, really deeply when you combine it with these other factors, you have a little bit of an injury. You have a strong belief that you're going to be able to prepare yourself and hit the ground running. And then if you combine that with the fact that he has a psychological self-protection mechanism built in here where he doesn't have to give Rafa a chance to beat him on clay. I mean, he skipped the whole clay court season. So he feels like he owns Rafa right now. But, I mean, we both know that that's different in Paris.
Well, sure.
I don't believe for a minute that Roger believes he's going to walk into Stade Roland Garros and beat Rafa in a final. I don't believe that.
I think he thinks it's possible.
Yes, it's possible, but that's different. And if you walk in there thinking that it's possible, you're probably going to lose.
Well, I don't know that I agree with that. But look, I get what you're saying about having to work hard at the French, and you're not wrong about that. But I'm just saying in terms of, I don't think his knee's like actively bothering him, right? I think he is worried and he's protecting it a little bit. But my point is, I think I'm far more likely to hurt my knee on grass courts than I am on clay courts. And that's what I'm getting at. I mean, I get him skipping the clay court swing. I think he could have shown up at Roland Garros. My point is this. I think this is not about the knee, and it's about prioritizing that he wants to win Wimbledon. It's the most important thing for him this year. And by God, he's going to put everything into doing that.
And I think that the knee combined with avoiding Rafa on the clay are just as big of factors as anything else. I really do.
Yeah, so I don't know that he really wants to avoid Rafa on the clay. I don't think there's a part of him, I think, that almost wants Rafa on the clay now. Because you think about it. This is not a guy who shied away from the big moments. You know,
this is not a guy who shied away from the big moments, but I'm sorry, this is a guy who shied away from attacking his backhand for 20 years.
Well, no, that's not... Okay.
In his own words...
Look, it's all
relative.
He's
the one who said, my coach... Yes, it's all relative. And this is relatively shying away from another player. Relatively.
Well, I don't think it's got anything to do with Rafa. I think it has nothing to do with Rafa. I think that Fed has a history of wanting to play the biggest players on the biggest stage. There's a part of him that if he's going to win a Roland Garros finals, he wants it to be Rafa that he plays in the final to win it. Because to him, when you think about the impact that Rafael Nadal has had on Federer's legacy and the impact their head-to-head has had on the way people view him as being or not being the greatest of all time, I think he wants to go out there and send a message to the world, just like he's done on the hardcore tournament so far this year, of, look, things are different now.
I think he wants to, too. I just don't buy it. Because, look, here's the thing to me.
Well, you either think he wants to or you don't think he wants to.
No, I think he wants to do it. I think he dreams of doing that. I don't think that he believes that he can. I think if he really thought what you think, if Roger Federer really thinks, I know how to beat Rafa, not just I know how to beat Rafa and Clyde, but like I know how to do it and I'm going to do it the next time I'm out there, then he's playing Roland Garros. Because, yes, he wants it to be at Wimbledon. Yes, he wants his 19. But if he believes that he's going to beat Rafael Nadal in Paris at Roland Garros at this point in time, that is like a guaranteed slam for him. He has been the second best clay court player.
Well, no, but he hasn't been the second best clay court player for like 6 or 7 years now. Let's be real. I mean, yes, if you look at his stretch back when he was making all those finals, absolutely, second best clay court player in the world, hands down. And you could make an argument during that stretch, he was the second best clay court player in the history of the sport.
Exactly, and that's what I was going to say. But he's got his mojo back.
But he's got his mojo back, yes. But he's got his mojo back in a way that's a little bit different. He can't go out and play the way that he was playing back in, you know, 06 when he's making the French Open final. And I think he's, in a sense, more vulnerable to other people now. Look, to me, at the end of the day, I think that if he plays the French, he compromises his preparation for Wimbledon. He's realized the value of having a block of time in which he can go out and just train and work on specific things. And I think that he has just made, I don't think it's got anything to do with Rafa. I think winning Wimbledon is so important to him that he's putting that above everything else. And he's stepping away from Roland Garros just purely to make sure he's as prepared for Wimbledon as he can possibly be. And that's, so I think that's everything.
So that's a very clear statement. So here's my final question to you before we move on. We're talking about Sharapova because we've got to address that as well. If 4 weeks ago Rafa Nadal had tweaked his knee in one of these clay court tournaments where he was dominating people and he said, oh, I'm going to be out for the clay court season and I'll be back on the grass, is Roger Federer still going to be skipping the French?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think it's. I think
you're consistent. I'll give you that. Because I don't buy that. I think that if Nadal isn't at the French Open this year, I think we would see Federer there.
Yeah, I don't. I think that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I think that he thinks if he prepares properly, he's going to win Wimbledon. I think he thinks if he played the French, he might or might not win the French. And that's the thing to me is he's vulnerable at the French to other people in a way that he just isn't at Wimbledon. If he goes out at Wimbledon and serves well and attacks the ball the way that he has been so far this year, he's just unstoppable.
I got to tell you, I would love nothing more than to see Nadal win the French so that we could have a vintage final between Federer and Nadal at Wimbledon with Nadal coming in with real belief, and Federer still having that. I mean, Federer's going to have that belief at Wimbledon. You're not going to take that
absolutely.
Away.
Absolutely. No, especially with this block of training.
I mean, that could be an all-time kind of...
It all depends. But I'm not sure that Rafa's going to follow up a win at the French with a Wimbledon final.
No, I'm not sure that he is.
It's not 08 anymore, you know? But yeah, we'll see what happens. But look, we could talk about that all day, and we almost have. Let's move on, because this is the interesting thing. I mean, like, Fed just sits there and says, you know what? I'm just going to skip the French, whereas Sharapova, you know, deeply wants to play. Right. And wasn't given the walkout. And look, I wanted to talk about this very much because there's been a lot of vitriol and hatred and just craziness online from people about Sharapova and how she's a cheater and this, that, and the other. And they think it's ridiculous that she got the wild cards that she got and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, obviously this big controversy with her and Jeannie Bouchard. And I think there's an element here where it's important to talk about because we have had other players in the last decade that have been suspended because of drugs. And when those players came back, they were not treated the way that Sharapova is being treated now. We are talking about a professional athlete who, yes, she was taking this drug Meldonium along with a slew of other professional athletes, tennis players, people in all kinds of athletic endeavors were taking this drug while it was legal. And if you think there's any professional tennis player out there who's serious and in the top 150 that has the resources to be doing what they need to do, that they're not taking advantage of every little piece that they can afford that's within the rules in order to win, then you're nuts. You're absolutely nuts.
Okay, I got to interrupt you there because I work with some of those guys, and I got to tell you, some of those guys are so paranoid about something showing up on one of these drug tests that they won't touch a multivitamin, literally.
Yeah, but that's okay. Different because you're not working with guys who have teams of people whose job is to monitor. Look,
you said top 150 with resources.
Well, I said, but I added the with resources thing for a reason, because the resources is an important part of it. Yeah, like if you don't have somebody who's literally you're paying just to sit around and make sure that you're not taking anything that was going to show up as being illegal and monitor what your vitamin and drug intake is, then yeah, you're going to be very, very careful.
Look, but I'm just saying from personal experience. I mean, I worked with a guy who went to the hospital because he got sick and failed a drug test because of what they gave him at the hospital.
Right.
Okay. And then he had to spend like $50,000 on his, you know, legal defense to go, you know, dig up everything and pay for testing and blah, 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 blah. And yeah, at the end of it, he ended up not being able to play tennis for two.
Yeah, but we're talking about these people that are in the top 10, top 20, top 30.
The top 20 guys, are they going to do that? There's a lot of guys that simply don't trust someone else to make those decisions for them because we have a lot of horror stories. And they learn these things. And this is where I think it links to Sharapova. You learn your attitude towards these things probably before you're 20 years old.
Sure.
Now, when Sharapova was 15 or 16 years old, she was already taking the stuff. And it was perfectly legal back then.
Yeah, but look, I added the with resources line for a reason. Because, yeah, if you have to do all this stuff yourself, you are going to be really, really, really careful. When you have a team of people who manage every aspect of your life, you're going to be a lot less careful. You're going to be a lot less paranoid. Because you've got a professional handling that side for you. And there's a lot of these top players, and they're using every little edge that they can. And, you know, for the fact that for whatever reason that she slipped up, and her team slipped up, and she ended up taking this thing for a few weeks past when it became a banned substance, and effectively played one tournament with it, that she did she even win the tournament? I don't remember.
But, it was the Australian Open.
Yeah, she didn't win the Australian Open that year.
No.
Right, so, and everyone's going nuts and like psycho at her online about how she's such a cheater and, you know, boo on this tournament for giving her a wild card and this, that, and the other. Look, what are wild cards for? Like, what's the purpose of a wild card?
Look, first of all, she's not a cheater. I think coming out and dropping these kind of names is just, I don't know what it is, but it's inappropriate and it shows that you haven't done your homework. I mean, you know, I studied exercise physiology in grad school. Look into the drugs. Look into what it does. It's not giving her an advantage. There's very specific reasons that the whole Russian Federation has all their athletes on that drug, or at least they used to, because of their own scientific beliefs. And if you delve into the academic literature, the scientific community basically argues about it. Okay.
Right. I mean, any benefit is very marginal. If there's a benefit, it's exceedingly small.
Well, The point that's really interesting to me is that the benefit that the Russian culture was going after was not a performance enhancing benefit. It's a protective benefit for long term life, like for quality of life after you retire from professional athletics. It wasn't about performance. And WADA, the drug testing organization, the World Anti-Doping Organization, WADA released a statement, I mean, a white paper on this, where they basically say, we're banning this preemptively. We can't find anything about it that proves it's performance enhancing, to say that with all the research that they've done, there is literally no proof that it's performance enhancing. But it was suspicious to them that the whole Russian Federation was taking it. And so they're just banning it basically just because they know the Russians have a history of, well, I mean, I hate to say it, but the Russians do have a history of breaking the rules in order to look for performance advantages.
Sure.
And now that goes in sports like track and field and stuff where, I mean, let's be real, like the Americans have a history of the same thing, and you look at cycling and the Tour de France and all that kind of stuff. Like,
yeah,
the,
no, you know, there's some never of these been sports any drugs in Tour de France. What are you talking about? Cycling's so clean.
Some of these sports, well, apparently it's much cleaner now, and we can tell because everyone's slower. But, you know, tennis does not have a problem like that. I mean, John McEnroe wasn't on performance-enhancing drugs, and Pete Sampras wasn't on performance-enhancing drugs. And as far as I believe, at least, I don't think that the top guys right now are on anything. But I can tell you, I mean, there's a big debate on the tour. A lot of these guys, even that are 35 in the world, they don't have the kind of resources that you're talking about. And you'll find one guy that says, man, I think everybody's taking stuff, and you know that's why they're better than me. And then you'll find another guy that says, man, I don't think they're taking anything. I tell you what, from a coaching perspective, when I look at the guys that are in the top 10, they work a lot harder than the guys that's 35. So that seems pretty clear.
Sure.
But, side notes.
I think the short of it is that I mean, essentially, yeah, there's a lot of this kind of violent anger towards Sharapova is unjustified. But then the second part of it is, like, when we look at what the purpose of a wild card is, you know, there's a few things. One is to give opportunities to up-and-coming players that maybe aren't at a place quite yet to actually qualify on their own, but you might identify a player that you think is going to end up being a top-level player, and so you give them that chance. And so an example of that would be Andy Roddick when he was younger and still coming up, and obviously he had some fantastic results in juniors. And so a lot of people don't realize this, but Andy Roddick never won a main draw match in a futures tournament.
Neither did I.
Well, but still, you know,
I'm just like Andy Roddick.
You never won a Grand Slam. You know, Andy Roddick never won a main draw futures match ever. Like, he played them, and he lost every single one that he played. And yet, what happened?
He did win a challenger, though.
Well, but how did he get in the challenger first place if he's not winning any matches? Exactly, he got a wild card because they looked at him and his junior results and said, this guy's going to be good. We're going to give him this opportunity, and so he got given the opportunity. Other reasons for wild cards are for players who have lost ranking points for whatever reason but are still a big draw, or who have been injured or out of the game. Like, so let's just say
you're calling this reasons for wild cards, but I think you should really be calling these sensible uses of wild cards.
Well, sure, because obviously that's not always what happens. But so, like, if Ennin came back right now and said, look, I'm going to play pro tennis again, you know, would anybody be all upset that she got a wild card into a tournament? Oh, heck no, because she's got a history of being a number one player. She won multiple Grand Slams. There's every reason in the world to give her a wild card because she doesn't have the ranking points. If you can take your emotional attachment to this idea of Sharapova being a cheater and put it aside for 5 minutes and just say, look, we accept Sharapova's been out of the game for a while, but she's a multiple Grand Slam winner, former world number one, and she's coming back without the ranking points, and she's a huge draw, do we give her a wild card? I mean, I think the answer is a heck yes. And I think it's extremely hypocritical of the French Federation to do that at the same time as they give a wild card to a French player who was banned for gambling on professional tennis matches, which is a blatant violation of the pro tennis rules.
Yeah, and to me that undermines the integrity of the game a lot more than taking heart medication does.
Yeah, I mean, look, they didn't just, like, lose the moral high ground when they gave that wild card out. They, like, took a running jump off the edge of the moral high ground, you know, and they didn't have a parachute on.
They dove into the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, that's just crazy, you know. And so I think that was very much, like, a very petty move on their part. It was kind of thoughtless. However you might feel about Sharapova as a person, you know, I don't know her. Yeah, I've heard a lot of mixed things. Like, yeah, sometimes she isn't great, you know, but she's not the only professional athlete who doesn't always.
She's a very hard worker. She's very professional. I think people don't like her because she's tall and she's pretty and she's taking up a large chunk of the money. I think that there's an argument to be made that she gets more attention than she should. You know, there were years where she wasn't winning slams and stuff, but realistically, I mean, she's won all four slams. There are very, very few women on the tour who have done that. She goes about her business in a thoughtful and purposeful way. She doesn't berate line judges like Serena Williams has. She doesn't, you know, have outbursts like that. I think that...
No, I mean, she has cussed out some crowds before.
She's cussed out some crowds, yeah, which, you know. I mean, in a sort of Nick Kyrgios kind of style that to me is like, look, I forgive Maria for doing that. I forgive Serena for doing that. She hasn't won as much as Serena has. She hasn't been as dominant of a player, and obviously Serena's dominated her head-to-head. But, you know, she's been a steady face on the tour for a long time. She's been very good for marketing. She's brought in a lot of money. A lot of the women on the tour realize that she's been very, very good for the tour. you know, I think that there's a way in which a lot of the girls dislike her in some sense because of the success that she's had. And I think that's fine as long as you use that to motivate you to then become better than her and go out there and post up better results. I don't think that you should trash talk her in the media saying things that are just inaccurate, you know, or make things up or do any of the other crap that's happened. I mean, if you look closely at the women's tour, it's different than the men's tour. The women stay to themselves a lot more. They have much, much smaller circles of peers in the sense of friends and people that they're close to. They have their own teams and they kind of stick to their own teams a lot more than the guys do. There's just less communication between a WTA player and another WTA player than there is between any ATP player and another ATP player.
Sure.
I mean, that's just the way that it is.
Yeah.
So
it is a very different culture.
I mean, to me, this wasn't a shock for the French Open not to give Sharapova a wild card, but to not even get her into the qualies. I mean, I think it would have been a little bit of a slap in the face to say, hey, play the qualies. I really do. I mean, she's a former champion, and it's not like she's coming out of retirement. Like,
right.
She honestly, the testing administration went after her hard. Okay, I don't know how much our listeners have really delved into this story, but if you go and you do your research, I mean, there are emails that were released that basically look like this was a witch hunt to go after Maria. And they viewed her as someone who was an acceptable target to sort of chase down and pin as proof that they're doing their jobs. And their job is not easy. They need more funding. They need more testing. It's hard to stay ahead of everything. I know that as well as anybody, and I wouldn't take that away from them. But there are certainly questions about the way that this all went down. And so for the French Open not to stand by the players, honestly, it's just a little bit disappointing. It's just disappointing for them not to say, hey, you know, she got busted. She stood up. She made a press conference. She admitted to it. But let's point out again, she did not do the whole cycling thing or track thing. She didn't get up there and lie about anything. She was very upfront, told us exactly what it was. Was she completely 100% forthcoming? There's no way for us to know. Let's assume that she wasn't. She still said more and admitted to more and did a better job than I think anybody else that I have seen in professional sports over the last decade. Period. So,
yeah. I mean
to me, like
she served her time.
She served her time.
She served her time.
She did it quietly. I mean, she went to Harvard and took business classes. Like, I think she's honestly, like, she set a pretty good example. I mean, you've got a young daughter. Like, I don't think you would look at what she's done and say, like, oh my God, it would be the end of the world if you ended up doing that. Like, she seemed to handle things pretty darn well, and just the way that the French Open handled things is very unimpressive. And
yeah.
And now she's playing qualies at Wimbledon, which I think is ludicrous. She's a former champion there. I mean,
well,
it's
she
great.
She neglected to, I mean, you know, she decided not to ask for a wild card. And just there's a part where I think that's not a bad move on her part because
it's a great PR move.
Well, it's not just a great PR move. I mean, I think that she gets matches that she sorely needs. You know, I mean, let's be real. Maria Sharapova is a better player than Jeannie Bouchard. And however you might feel about Jeannie Bouchard and Maria Sharapova, Maria Sharapova has the career to show that she's a better player than Jeannie Bouchard. And her loss the other day shows, I think, part of the lack of match practice and also some of this emotional junk that's coming along with all of this. This is a tough situation.
It is. And
I think that it's going to be healthy for Maria to go and play those qualifying matches, hopefully work our way through to the main draw, and then we see what happens. Look, tennis, women's tennis needs some recognizable figures, and I think that her coming back and playing good ball would be good for the game.
Look, it's going to be dangerous. I've been to those courts out in Roehampton. Roehampton is where they play the qualifying tournament for Wimbledon. So if you're not aware, the qualifying tournament for Wimbledon is not played on the main courts. And like you mentioned earlier about Federer's knee and it being more likely to do damage on grass, but if you're Maria Sharapova or Roger Federer, you only play on about 3 courts at Wimbledon. And those courts are
pristine.
The best grass courts in the world. There's almost no damage of hurting anything. I mean, they are they are more level than most of the hard courts that I play on, and that is not an exaggeration. They're unbelievable. But the courts at Roehampton are, I mean, it's a cricket field. It's literally a cricket field. It's a completely different set of circumstances, and she might have some close matches out there. I mean, she should be able to just roll everybody, but there's players that are in the qualies there that used to be top 30 in the world that can step up and play some really good ball.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of players out there that would love nothing more than to take out Murray on grass. And if you're going to do it, you're probably not going to do it at center court at Wimbledon. You're probably not going to do it on court one at Wimbledon. But the chances go way up when you're at court six at Roehampton. She's going to get bad bounces. She's going to get some bad line calls. She's going to have to play some players that are just as good as the. I mean, they're going to be girls that have played her before.
Right.
It's going to be interesting.
And also, coming back to this whole kind of response that a lot of people have had to her, I mean, there's every chance that she might face some very, very hostile people that are going to be a lot closer physically to the court than she's used to, and with a lot less of kind of like the security and whatnot. I mean, she just may be playing in an incredibly hostile environment on tough courts. You know, I mean, it's just not going to be a pleasant experience, I think, as a whole. But you know what? Who knows? Maybe this will be exactly what she needs to kind of feel like she's proving herself. And look, I mean, like I said, I think it's good for the game if she comes back and plays well. I don't think you have to like Maria Sharapova. Like I said, there's some stuff that she's done that you might think, okay, this isn't such a likable person. We can say the same about many of the top athletes. I mean, Serena, you could say that far more easily about, given some of her behavior. I think if you're going to dislike her, just dislike her for, you know, good reasons, not because she's a quote-unquote cheater that doesn't ever deserve a wild card or apparently to ever play tennis again, you know? Like, I just think that's just overly dramatic and unnecessary.
And to be fair, a lot of the players, I mean, really, like, they're not saying this, but a lot of the players just don't want the competition. Yeah. I mean, when Maria's there, they're taking money. She's taking money out of their pocket. And so it's totally understandable to me. Like, there's nothing that, like, I would hold against any of those girls or any of the guys for the same way. It's like, right. I mean, the guys in the main draw at Roland Garros are elated that Federer's not there. Because
it's
like money in your pocket.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people just don't, like, if you're listening, you got to realize that, like, not everybody playing professional tennis is a millionaire, you know?
No.
And for a lot of these guys, like, they're literally out there working their butts off to make just a good living. Like,
a lot of these guys have been killing themselves for 20 years.
Right.
And they're just hoping to be able, like, they literally don't know what they're going to do when they're retired, or if they tear something in their ankle or their knee, they're screwed. They've got no idea what would be next.
Yeah, and I mean, so, if you're Donald Young or Daniel Evans or, you know, I don't know, there's like a bunch of guys in the top 100 that are going to be playing this tournament that just don't have this massive bank of savings from, you know, winning multiple tournaments that, you know, where they've got $500,000 in the bank. You know, these people, like, they spend a lot of money traveling every year. And so when a guy like Federer doesn't play a tournament, I mean, it's a very happy day if you're Steve Darcis. Because
Darcis is a much better example than Young. Just ironically picked the one guy with $1 million contract.
Well, sure. But, you know, like Darcis, you know, if you're Darcis, Federer not playing, if the draw comes out the right way, could literally mean you make an extra $50,000.
$150,000.
Which is a big deal. Who knows, you know? Like, it's just, that's a big deal. But, yeah, so in the women's side of things, obviously, especially with Serena now gone, you have this huge vacuum at the top of the game.
There's no favorite.
No favorite
to win.
Either
one of those tournaments. I mean, it's really, really interesting. We should probably talk about that more later on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, obviously we don't spend a lot of time talking about the WTA as much, but this is going to be a very, very interesting French Open for sure. But as always, folks, we'd love to hear from you. We've had some great emails and feedback from people over the last few weeks. Keep it coming. You know, you can reach me at Glenn with one N, just GLEN at tacticaltennis.com.
I'm Jacob at tacticaltennis.com.
And, you know, keep coming to the website. Share it with your friends. We have the podcast now on Stitcher. So for those of you who are Stitcher users, you can find us there and still on iTunes. Have a good one, people.
Take it easy.